12 years ago, the Des Moines Police Department started its canine unit. The department now has 4 dogs on patrol with officers. But how are they actually used? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, the story of a German Shepherd named Bello, who made a crucial catch.
If I didn't have Bello with me, with my ankle the way it was, there has been no way I'd be able to catch up with the suspect, so therefore this guy could still be out on the street.
A conversation with officers in the Des Moines Police Department's canine unit. Then we'll hear from Denise O'Brien of Atlantic, Iowa. She's just returned from a year in Afghanistan working for the USDA. We take a bite out of crime after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining me now, 2 canine officers with the Des Moines Police Department, Officer Cordell Miller and Officer Larry Gilmore. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We wanted to have you tell this story, a fascinating story we read about in the Des Moines Register. Let's start with the story and then find out more about your canine unit. Earlier this month, just after midnight, you, Officer Cordell Miller, and your canine, Bello, were called to the southeast part of the city, and you responded to the report of a man wanted on warrants. While on your way, you learned that the man had left the area in a red Chevrolet Cavalier, I understand, and Officer Miller, you found a car and a suspect matching the description in a convenience store parking lot. Tell us what happened then.
Once I came in contact with the suspect, I had a pretty good idea it was him just based upon his actions. He was acting real nervous, and once I did make contact with him, that's when he began to run. Of course, I pursued after him, and I announced my canine warning for him to stop, and of course, he failed to stop. And as I was running after him, I twisted my ankle and sprained it pretty good.
So Bello, your canine, your dog, is in the patrol car at this point.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So this, the protocol, the procedure is you tell him to stop, the suspect to stop, you pursue when he doesn't stop, and so how far are you away when you twist your ankle?
I'm probably about 20, 25 yards away from the squad car.
Mm-hmm. So from the squad car, you twist your ankle. I assume what happens next? You try to get up?
Well, I didn't completely fall down. I just knew as soon as I did it, I knew it was going to be a bad situation. I wasn't going to be able to pursue after the suspect, in full flight. And so once I announced my canine warning as I was running after him.
What is that canine warning? What did you say exactly?
I said, stop or I'll release the dog. I announced that twice.
And he's still running. He's a distance away from you, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's probably getting another 20, 25 yards in front of me, if not farther.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so he hears you, and he continues. He doesn't stop.
Yep, that's correct. Yeah, he continues to run, and at which point, based upon I knew this is our guy, and he had active warrants, based upon me not being able to pursue after him, I popped the door with the button I have on my gun belt, which pops the door for Bello to exit the vehicle, and when he did, I gave him the commands to pursue and apprehend the suspect.
What are those commands for the dog?
it's a German command that we use.
Oh, is that something that we can hear, or is that something you're not allowed to share?
We usually don't share that command so that the public or other people don't know that command, so that by chance they could take control of our dogs.
I understand. So you gave the command to Bello to pursue. What happened then?
Bello came out of the exit of the squad car. He pursued after the suspect, and once he caught up to the suspect, he apprehended the suspect by biting him on the left arm, and at which time the suspect began to fight a little bit. Bello came off the bite, and the suspect continued to run again, and I'm still shouting my warnings for him to stop, and Bello pursued after him again, at which time Bello caught up to him and apprehended him, bit the suspect on his back. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was able to catch up to Bello and the suspect, now the suspect has Bello kind of chasing by these, there's two big pallets of mulch by the grocery store there. And I had my taser out, and he kind of had Bello wedged between the pallets of mulch. And at that time, he was hitting Bello to get Bello off the, you know, of course, the bite. And I told the suspect to stop fighting my dog or he would be tased, and he continued to fight with the dog. So I deployed the taser, which just struck the suspect on the left-hand side. And Bello was on the right-hand side, so Bello, I knew, would not be affected by the taser. At that time, the taser worked successfully, at which point the suspect began to fall to the ground. And about that time, I went over and took the suspect into custody.
Okay, so you were able to put cuffs on him or apprehend him in some way,
right,
so that he could not leave again. So the success story, before we talk to you, Officer Gilmore, Cordell Miller, Officer Miller, had you ever been able to use your canine in this way before? Does this happen often?
No, this is my very first encounter with this type of situation.
Mm-hmm. So he performed as he was trained, and it sounds like amazingly.
That's correct, yeah. This type of scenario we've trained numerous times before as to, you know, it's basically, it's handler protection, in which the decoy kind of fights with us a little bit, and we pop the door for the dog to exit out. And, yeah, this real-life situation was, we've practiced numerous times in training.
If you've just joined us, my guests for this part of River to River are canine officers with the Des Moines Police Department. I've just been listening to Cordell Miller, Officer Miller, involved in that incident earlier this month. Officer Larry Gilmore with us as well. And Officer Gilmore, I understand you are the in-house trainer of the department's canine unit.
Yes.
So Bello is a piece of your work, and he got a lot of praise after this, I assume, from you and others.
Yes. It's just not my work. It's actually it's the handler that makes the dog. I know the basics to get the guys through the 6-week course that we do, mm-hmm. and we're training both the dog and the handler. And then when we're done with that 6 weeks, these guys go on and they make these dogs out to be what they are.
Okay, so describe a little bit of that 6-week training program with the officers and the dogs.
We certify through the United States Police Canine Association. So I attended a trainer's course through them, and that was in St. Paul, Minnesota. And returned, and about a year and a half later, we were able to add some additional canines to our program. And Cordell and Bello and two additional officers were able to become part of the unit. So mm-hmm. We did a 6-week training course in-house, and then they graduated, and two of them were able to certify right away. One of them was not because of an injury to the dog, and they've been out on the street since, doing a good job.
What type of tasks, what type of skills are they taught in this training?
The basic USPCA certification, which is what we focus on for the most part, is narcotics and patrol work. For this incident's patrol work, we certify doing hurdles and agility type things, like a 6-foot jump and a broad jump and a crawl. And then that teaches a dog how to respond to what we need him to do on the street. Or gives them a good foundation, and then we start getting into more realistic things like actual fences and stuff. And then the apprehension phases, we teach control. The dogs need to be able to out on a verbal command or not even respond without a command. We would call that like the false start that we do for the USPCA or the actual apprehension phase. Mm-hmm. And then we even have a recall phase. Say this person did stop after Cordell's commands, and Cordell would be able to recall his dog back to him and not require an apprehension, which is something we train for. And then we have other things we do, like evidence searches or article searches. You would throw an article out into a field, and the dogs would be able to locate that article with their nose.
Mm-hmm. We just heard that account. Is there anything that Bello didn't do right in this case? Anything that could have been better?
No, this Cordell, no, not at all. I mean, Bello did exactly what he was supposed to do, and I'm very proud of him. You know, like I said before, I mean, we practiced this scenario in training numerous times before, and he did well. He did exactly what he was supposed to do, and he took care of me, and was able to apprehend the suspect. I mean, if I didn't have Bello with me, with my ankle the way it was, there has been no way I'd be able to catch up with the suspect. So Therefore, this guy will not have been caught and could still be out on the street roaming around.
It sounds like, though, the training of Bello and the other dogs, and I understand you have four of them in your unit, your canine unit now.
That's correct.
That apprehending a suspect, this type of deployment is a very small part of what they're trained to do.
Oh, definitely, definitely. The biggest thing they do is they use their nose to locate people or whatever we want them to find, be it narcotics or they'll search buildings, they'll do area searches, like if you had a suspect or somebody lost in a cornfield. Tracking is a major part. So everything that they do for us through their nose. And they're a locating tool.
I've heard this before or read about it, but do you know offhand how much more sensitive a dog's nose is than ours?
Oh, goodness. There's many examples you hear. I always like this one. It's easy to catch on to. It's like an example of like the birthday cake. And, you know, when you bake the cake, you smell the entire cake. We do. But the dog is going to smell each one of those ingredients, like the sugar, the flour, and all those things all together. That's how sensitive their noses are and what they can smell.
I understand that, Officer Gilmore, you had a dog retired in January. You adopted him as a pet, Caesar?
Yes, yes.
Tell us a little bit about that. When is a dog need to be retired?
Well, they could last on average, it's about 5 years. But they could go 8 or 9 years. We had a dog go 9. That was Emir. And unfortunately, he got cancer and unexpectedly and passed away.
Their strength and agility just disappears, or is it something mental?
No, they're dogs, they're animals. It could be anything from tumors that they may have or cancer. For mine, it was just an injury to his back and his leg, and it just wasn't beneficial for anybody to keep him working. So it was better for him to retire.
Tell me, what is involved in transitioning a dog from a working dog in the canine unit at the Des Moines Police Department to having a pet? Is there a transition involved there?
Well, it's like anything. If you don't train, you lose it. So if we wouldn't do any training with our dogs, then they would start to forget what we've tried to teach them and we try to maintain. So, you know, my partner, I'm sure if I said something, he'd think about it and he'd probably remember. It hasn't been that long. But I maintain the obedience, so he's still an obedient dog. But I don't go out in my backyard or anything and do any apprehension work or any of that. He's a dog now. He gets treats. He never used to have those. He was a working dog. So
you would be a good one to ask about that old saying: "You can't teach an old dog new tricks." Is that true?
Oh, sure. You can always train a dog to do things, but but yeah, if you don't use it, they lose it.
Your dog now retired after years of service, Caesar. Now your pet. I wonder if you had an instance that you can recall when you were with Caesar, a story of a job well done by Caesar.
Oh, yes, of course. There's many. It's kind of like being a dad when they're successful and they do everything you've trained them to do. There's also many that stick out. There was a stolen car, and it just occurred. I was heading that way looking for the car and observed the vehicle, turned around, and then they attempted to go down another street and actually attempt to elude me. And backup was on the way. Other officers were on the way. And as I was updating them where we were, and the car really didn't stop. It kept rolling. They didn't put it into park. And there was three occupants, and they all jumped out of the vehicle and started running. And I yelled my canine warning, told them to stop. And the driver, none of them did, and it ended up that the driver and the passenger ended up running almost side by side. And after giving my warning and them not stopping, it even looked back at me to see if the dog was coming. And I released Caesar on command, and he went down. He started to go for the driver, and the driver actually stopped and put his hands up and started to comply. And then Caesar was directed to the passenger and apprehended the passenger. And I cuffed up the driver and then went over to the passenger and got him cuffed up. Told Caesar to release. He released. And then I gave him the command to go back to the squad car, and he went back to the car. And then there was a third person in the back, like I had said, and he wanted nothing to do with anything that was going on other than to lay down on the ground for me like I told him to. So three people in custody in a brief time before my backup could arrive just because my partner was there and could do a good job. So.
When faced with a German Shepherd trained as you have trained, had Caesar trained, had Bello trained, will most suspects trying to elude capture lay down, or will they fight, as in the previous instance?
You know, to be honest with you, just the presence of the dog is enough, usually. That when you pull up in a squad car and you have a dog and they're barking and they're letting everybody know that they're there because they're wanting to come out and be engaged and be involved, and you're dealing with these people and, you know, the officers that are there, and then when we show up, they're like, wow, his attitude totally changed when the canine officer showed up.
Right.
I mean, it's just... It really gives them a moment of pause to think about, hey, do I really want to have to not only fight these officers, but maybe even have to fight a police dog?
You police officers can get injured, even fatally injured, in the line of duty. Does that happen to these types of dogs as well?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, they're like the tip of the sword, you could say. They're in the front. They're taking the lead. They're bringing us to the danger. And unfortunately, they have been.
In your unit?
In our unit, yes. If you recall, well, not an actual death, but if you recall, I don't know if you remember Reno, the handler was Officer Tim Nading and his dog. They were looking for a suspect that was armed and had already been involved in a shooting. And Reno was shot by the suspect. He was able to recover and actually come back to work and work for a couple more years before he retired. But it does happen. The dogs are injured or they... they pay the ultimate price too. So.
Mm-hmm. Where do these dogs come from?
All of our dogs are from Slovak or Eastern Europe. They come from overseas. We got our canines through Evansville, Indiana, with the top dog police canine academy through John Howler there, and that's where we started our training. And it was a 6-week course also, and then he still was our vendor, and that's where we got our dogs from.
Bello and the other dogs are all German Shepherds.
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Why is the place to get these Eastern Europe or Central Europe?
That's a good question. There's all kind of arguments out there. Generally, you find a lot of the better dogs in Eastern Europe. It's not that they're not any here in the U.S. or closer. Some say that there's overbreeding, so you don't get the best dog that you can, but... really, for us, that's where our vendor or where our trainer was getting them, and that's mm-hmm. where we got them.
So you're saying a better lineage or better training?
Sure. There's no training. Typically, these dogs are what they would call green. There's no real training with them. They haven't learned to sit or down or do anything until we get them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they have a little so that when people come out to look at them to purchase that they've had something to show what they can and can't do already at their age. And nowadays, you can't find a dog. It should be about 2 years old is your dog that you're wanting to find and purchase. And anymore, they're all about a year old or younger because there's such a demand.
Mm-hmm. I imagine for both of you, it's hard not to develop or why not develop a personal relationship with these dogs. You have close relationships with these dogs.
Oh, you have to. Yeah, to get them to do what you want, and to you have to have that bond and have them want to please you and do the things that you want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And with these dogs, this Cordell, you know, these dogs, we work a 10-hour schedule, so, you know, we're with these dogs 10 hours out of the day, and, you know, actually I'd spend more time with my dog than I do with my wife and child, you know, and because by the time I get home, they're both still asleep, and when I go to bed and when I get up, I might spend a few more hours with them, but... You know, for the most part, I spend more time with my dog than I do with my family. And, yeah, I mean, you do. You develop a very strong bond, and, you know, you rely on him, and he relies on you, and, you know, that's your buddy, you know.
Mm-hmm. When you're traveling around town, is it okay? Do you walk him? Are you ever on foot patrol?
No. We just specifically drive around, and we take our regular patrol trips and assist on whatever we're needed for, either it's building searches or narcotic sniffs for a vehicle or just whatever they need us for.
Mm-hmm. So Bello is in the back seat?
That's correct, yep.
Mm-hmm. In all your patrols?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is he doing when he's not needed?
Yeah, it just depends. I mean, he's either excited or, you know, just kind of alert, looking around, or, you know, he'll glance back there and he's passed out asleep. So it just depends on the night, you know. Of course, weekends we're pretty busy, and, you know, during the week it slows down. So it just depends on the night, and he'd either be asleep or alert and barking. Just depends. Right.
Did both of you, or Cordell Miller, did you grow up with a dog?
I did. I've always had dogs, labs, shepherds, bulldogs. So, yeah, I've always had some type of dog.
Mm-hmm. Are you ever surprised or perhaps have some awe at how dogs can understand and interact with us?
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing how smart these dogs are. I mean, you know, it's going to work. I mean, they're just a totally different dog. And then, you know, going home, it's just like a light switch. They just totally flip to a whole different dog, and they're just like a regular pet at home, you know. As far as their abilities and what they can do, and, you know, how you train them and what they pick up on, it's amazing. You know, a lot of these dogs don't get credit for how smart they are.
Mm-hmm. Officer Gilmore, you grew up with a dog as well?
When I was young, yes.
Yes.
I remember a few Dobermans and different sized dogs as we grew up. It is amazing what they can do. It comes down to, you could be riding around in your car and they learn your number. You'll have an identifier for when the dispatch is calling you, and when they hear that number, they start to whine, and they know something's going on, and you'll key up the mic, and they'll be barking because they're excited because they think they get to go do something. Just the sound of the engine.
Mm-hmm.
If you start picking up speed to go to a call, or you turn on your lights. There was even a time when we used to train out on East 14th Street there at the animal shelter, the ARL now. And that's where all the agility equipment was. Well, and they love to do agility and the jump and to run. And so the sound of the tires going over the bridge as you go south on East 14th would key my dog. He would hear that, and he'd know we were close to the animal shelter, and that he would think that we were going to go down and do agility.
So Bello is actually, or any of these dogs, while sitting in the back seat, they may appear to be snoozing or not paying attention, but if they hear your unit called, he's listening to your radio.
They're always listening. They're always wanting to know what's going on and wanting to do something. Yeah, you bet.
That is amazing. Well, I want to thank you, Officers Miller and Gilmore, for coming into our studio, sharing this amazing story. Take care of Bello. Did he get an extra treat?
Oh, he did. He got a little prime rib the next night, but like I said, I'm very proud of him, and he did what he's supposed to do.
Okay, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
You bet.
Police officers Cordell Miller and Larry Gilmore of the Des Moines Police Department's K-9 unit. You can see a photo of Officer Miller with his crime-busting K-9, Bello, on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Coming up, a conversation with Denise O'Brien, an organic farmer and advocate from Atlantic, Iowa. O'Brien just returned from spending a year living and working in rural Afghanistan as an advisor for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That's coming up. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 1 year ago, 61-year-old Denise O'Brien left her organic farm just outside of Atlantic in southwest Iowa to embark on an adventure in Afghanistan. Her mission? To serve as U.S. Department of Agriculture advisor in Jalalabad, where she would work with farmers as part of a reconstruction team. Denise O'Brien has spent most of her life in agriculture. In 1997, she co-founded the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network and served as its director for more than 11 years. In 2006, she ran as the Democratic candidate for Iowa Secretary of Agriculture against the eventual winner, Bill Northey. Denise O'Brien returned from Afghanistan earlier this month, and earlier this week, I talked with her from her farmstead in Atlantic. Denise O'Brien, welcome to River to River.
Thank you, Ben. I'm glad to be here.
Describe where exactly you were in Afghanistan and a little bit about your mission.
I was in Nangarhar province, which is a province that borders Pakistan, and I was near the city of Jalalabad, and I was on a base called Findlay Shields. It's called a FOB, a Forward Operating Base.
So, and your mission there at the FOB?
My mission was to work with agriculture in Nangarhar province, and my job description was to mentor and work with the director of agriculture in, he was called the Dale, it was Engineer Safi, and it's the director of agriculture, irrigation, and livestock.
Okay, so being an organic farmer and an advocate from Atlantic, Iowa, I have to believe that the soil, the conditions for growing, for livestock were quite a bit different there, right?
Oh my gosh, I was just thinking of that. I've just come in from planting some of my spring garden. I was in, I just relish walking in healthy Iowa soil. It's just, it's mm-hmm. no rocks.
Okay, so over there, what did you have to work with?
It was mostly sand and clay, and it was in a very mountain, well, I was in a valley, but the mountains were all around it, the Hindu Kush, mm-hmm. They're called, and just huge amounts of vast, non-productive land.
Mm-hmm. So what could you do with it, agriculture-wise?
Well, I'll tell you, Ben, I was really surprised when I flew into Nangarhar province, when I flew into Jalalabad, I was totally amazed. I was coming in by helicopter. I got to most of my trips around the country were by helicopter. I was taken away by the greenness of the area that I was flying into. And in the 1st of April, so spring wheat was coming up. The wheat had been planted in the fall. And so I was amazed at the greenness of everything. And the greenness stopped after the irrigation stopped. So there was definite lines of here is where the irrigation stopped and there is where the desert began. So they do have a fertile amount of area around the rivers that run through Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Hindu Kush Mountains. I imagine great scenery.
It was incredible. And in fact, the area I was in was very similar to Colorado Springs. It was like looking out on Pikes Peak and, mm-hmm. The Rocky Mountains and having a sort of semi-desert, in the foreground.
Tell me about your typical day, Denise.
Well, my typical day would start, I launched right into a exercise program because I knew I'd have really trouble keeping my weight down and keeping my head in a good place. So I started at about 4:30 in the morning and did a couple hours of exercise, and then at 7:45 every morning, I had to be at a briefing, and that was a briefing with the military and the civilians who were working there. There were civilians representing the Department of Justice, the Department of State, and USAID, the United States Agency for Development. And so we would be together for 15 to 30 minutes on every morning to report in, to say what we were doing, what we had done yesterday, what we were going to be doing in the future, and then on. And then after that, we would all go to breakfast, and then I would go to my office. And mostly, it was a computer sitting at my desk type of job, a lot of it. But there were days that I would go out on mission, and the missions would be pretty much all-day missions. And describing a mission would be that we would prepare to go out into the countryside to visit with extension agents or farmers or the governor. And so it took us a lot of preparation to be able to do that, and it was quite a task to get a mission underway.
Mm-hmm. And these are missions to meet and work with Afghanis.
Correct, yes.
How were you generally received?
Oh, very well. People, I think, for the most part, were very glad we were there. They're very concerned about us leaving and what's going to happen when we leave. And our job, most of the people that I was working with, our job was to more or less wean them off of their dependence on monetary assistance from the United States government and mm-hmm. to prepare them to be taking the reins of their government and taking care of themselves.
I noticed, picking up on that, in your blog, you make something like the observation that contributions from the international community towards Afghanistan have been, I think, misguided, the word that you meant, to create some sort of welfare state. Is that what you're talking about?
I was, and I know that sounds rather harsh, but we've been there for 10 years. We've been in Afghanistan, and when we first went into Afghanistan, they used the military and the civilians used money as a incentive to help develop the country and everything. But in my opinion, and being an American taxpayer, I was looking and evaluating the last 10 years of projects, I was kind of appalled about how much money had been spent there, and with not that great of results.
And going into the pockets of warlords or those types?
Well, sometimes, yes. The warlords, there's thugs, they're just, a lot of it has been transferred to that. And I think I even read some articles where, you know, the Taliban probably had gotten some of it. But it's a culture of tribal nations, and it will probably more than likely revert to that once we leave, and the tribes will again fight over territory.
So, and I know you're not an expert in this area, but
no.
As we have conducted this war for over 10 years and the aid there too, given the culture, did you see an obvious way to avoid the continuation of the corruption that we became a part of?
Well, you know, I've been a community organizer and an activist all my life, and so I certainly came to it from a different way. And I think if there would have been some community organizing techniques used, I think that there would have been better ownership of the projects that went on. And what by that I mean that the community would be involved in the decision-making process about what was happening. Instead of top-down, it would be bottom-up. And I think there needed to be a mix of that. And if you're absolutely right, I'm no expert. I can't say that this would have worked either. But I think when communities are involved with their own problems and solutions, then I think you get different results.
How did you receive this appointment, Denise, to work as part of this reconstruction team for the USDA?
Well, I applied for it. I was at a time in my life where I wanted to do something different, and I'm healthy, I'm adventuresome, and so I was looking at job sites on usajobs.gov, I think it was, and someone had suggested that to me, and I saw this, and I looked at it, and I saw that there was a deadline for in July, and I think I saw it in about April or so, and I thought about it, and every once in a while I go back and look at it, and then it got to be June, and I thought, oh, well, if I'm going to do this, I better do it. And so I got, and as I read through the qualifications, I thought, well, boy, you know, I'm pretty qualified to do that, especially with 36 years of farming. So I applied and was accepted and was trained and have spent that year in a privileged place, I think, in my lifetime. For me to have experience.
You were there 1 year, April 2011 through the end of March of this year. Let's go back to Denise O'Brien, just about to leave in March of 2011. Do you remember the concerns you had setting out?
I had been through a month of training by that time. I actually left my farm on February 24th and was in Washington, D.C. for 4 weeks of training. And so during that time, I went to class every day, was briefed on things. I met people that I went to Afghanistan with and became very good friends with and when I was leaving to go away, I think the moment it really struck me was the last moments on the telephone with my husband calling. I was calling him from, you know, right from the gateway and at Dulles International Airport, and was thinking, oh my gosh, can I really do this? And yet I've done a lot of traveling and experienced a lot of different cultures in my lifetime, and so I knew the biggest part would be to get over that initial leaving.
Denise, what would you say, what part of your mission, and I know you talked about missions as going out on missions, but I mean in the overall mission, what part of your mission, your role there, are you most proud of now a year after and returning from that?
Going out into the countryside meant that I went out in a huge tank surrounded by 20-plus soldiers with, you know, dressed in helmet and body armor and that. There wasn't a lot of, you know, close contact with the farmers themselves. So what I feel like maybe that I was helpful with over there was helping the military understand small business enterprise and small farming, because it's a totally different kind of farming. It's a very similar, there's parallels to different things that are in our country that we've embraced in our country, an industrial model, and mm-hmm. and yet there's this undercurrent of local foods and that, and there are just some real parallels about what exists in infrastructure in each country. So I hope I helped the Afghani people through my help and expertise and advice with the Missouri National Guard, who I spend a lot of time with. Yes.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Denise O'Brien. She's just returned from a year abroad in Afghanistan as a USDA advisor, where she worked as part of a reconstruction team. You were talking about things that you helped out, how you benefited the Afghan people. Were there things you were able to bring back, things you didn't know after decades of being a farmer yourself, from those farmers? Did you learn something too?
Well, you know, I really did. I feel like, in some ways, I feel like I came back with more than I gave. You know, I received more than I gave. But one day I was walking on this mission down to a local village. We didn't have to get in our tanks. We could just walk outside the base, but we still had to have our armor on and everything. But anyway, I was walking down the village. I was looking at the plants. There was Nangarhar province was very well known for its cauliflower that grew there. And it was in the winter time, although winter there is not like here. But so the plants were growing, and I saw how they had raised beds, and they had their irrigation going, and they formed their irrigation through water, little canals and things. And it occurred to me that we had many discussions were about how we could get them to use, how we could get the Afghans to use irrigation, drip irrigation, and reuse the limited water resource as much as possible, as efficiently as possible. And I was walking in this village, and I thought, it was kind of like an epiphany. It's like, they know how to do this. They've done it for 1,000 years or more, and this works for them. And it went on my thinking, my line of thinking on that was like, how much on my farm we use drip irrigation, and how much I just battle with the tubing and laying it out, and the rodents eating it, and sprinkler, you know, just all of the different problems I have. And I think, why do I want to show them all my frustrations that I have with drip irrigation? So,
right, that doesn't happen in the canal, does it?
No.
You've mentioned a few times going out in tanks. You mentioned the troops that were protecting you.
Yes.
I've seen a photo of you on your blog. You have body armor on,
yes.
and your mission was not without danger. Did you get yourself into some tight spots?
Well, people always ask me, did you feel safe there? Well, I was on a base, and we were surrounded by villages and that, but the base had in the past had been hit with what they call RPGs, all the time I was there, that didn't happen. It happened to a base that was close to us, but not to us directly. So when I went out, I felt fairly safe. These men and women were very well trained to take care of me, and so I felt very protected. I was the package. I was considered the package, and I was always in a bubble. There were a couple instances that happened that there was an IED and improvised explosive device that went off in front of the tank ahead of us, and it was a big explosion. We were driving down the road going back to the base after we had done a visit to a veterinary clinic, and so no one was hurt. The truck was a bit damaged, but not much. But it took us hours to be there to get all the reconnaissance done on it and everything. So. And the guys kept saying to me, the soldiers kept saying, but you're so calm. And I said, well, all you need is a hysterical civilian to be, you know, in the back of your tank that you have to take care of in addition to your other stuff. And yeah. And so there were a couple times when things were close calls, but not as much as other people have experienced, for sure.
And the group that was protecting you, I understand, was Missouri members of the Missouri National Guard.
Yes, wonderful guys.
I see a picture on your blog of them, too.
Yes. Oh, they were just wonderful, and women. There were not that many women. The majority were, of course, men. But they were policemen and highway patrolmen and businessmen and everything doing there. And Iowa was in the province north of me, so I never did see many Iowans, or any Iowans, I think. But the guys and I, we really had a good relationship, and I just really enjoyed knowing them as people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I understand. On one of your missions, a sniper took a shot at the gunner in the Missouri yes. National Guard?
Yeah, that was the second thing. We were looking at a fish hatchery that day, and we were out at the fish hatchery, and we were talking to the farmer there, and all of a sudden there was a couple shots, and we kind of looked around and thought, well, no, that was something. And then over the radio it came, you know, gunner down, and so... They rushed me back and into the tank and put me in a tank. And then when we would go out on a mission, they would put the tanks to be ready to go. They'd drop us off, and then they'd arrange the tanks to be ready to go and get out of anywhere fast. And the driver and the gunner always stayed with the vehicle, and the vehicle was always running. And so we were kind of in a bowl area, and there was a shot. The shot came from a high, like a tower above, and it just happened to hit this guy in on his helmet, and it didn't penetrate the helmet. The way he was injured was he was knocked unconscious, because they explained that the concussion of the bullet was about like a 12-pound sledgehammer hitting someone.
So, oh my gosh!
Yeah, so it was a big, you know, hit. And this guy had served in Iraq and he had served in Afghanistan, and I believe they said that it was like his ninth incident of something like that happened. So it was like he seemed like a magnet. But he came through it okay. We rushed out of there, rushed to a base, and they life-flighted him to out and got him back to Missouri. And I think he's had some nerve damage in his back from this, but he was from the Kansas City area.
Did these close calls or these incidents and the fact that you were able to keep calm, as you mentioned, when this happened, did that change the feeling of you in your group? Did it bond you to the
yeah.
men?
Yeah, you got it, Ben. It does, yes. There was just like... wow, she can really deal with this. And I have to say, as a 62-year-old woman, I was actually probably one of the oldest, if not the oldest person on my base of about 700 people, which was kind of shocking to me. But there were people close to my age, but in the National Guard, they retire people at 60, so I knew none of those guys were that old. And then the other people who were maybe civilians or working in different parts of the different sectors, you know, they kind of, you just don't go up to somebody and say, well, how old are you? So
sure.
I had to surmise it, but everyone, was younger. And so a lot of times before those things happened, I think they kind of were wondering about how I would react to things and how I would get through it.
The U.S. is in the process, of course, of extricating itself from this very, very long war.
Yes.
From
yes.
what you have witnessed in the year that you have been there, can coalition forces begin to draw down completely, leave the country, and not have it descend into chaos and instability?
Well, that's a big question. There's people just waiting for us to leave, Afghans that want to grab something. And so there's going to be some piece of something, you know, whether it was a buildings or roads or whatever we helped to improve there, we and the rest of the coalition forces. And so I can't help but think that there's going to be some chaos. And I don't want to say chaos, because hopefully it won't descend into chaos, but there will be disruption, I guess is the word
yeah,
that I'm trying to find, because people will be trying to stake their claim once
right.
we're gone.
It doesn't sound, from what I'm hearing from you, that the relative stability and progress recently in Afghanistan won't continue after U.S. troops pull out.
Well, no, and there's indications of it now, you know, with the Koran burning and the reaction to that, and, you know, and the the different things that have happened, and that I keep tab on the news as much as I can about things. And I think we've made improvements. I think we maybe should have left a while ago. And we were there not to occupy their country, but to get rid of the Taliban. And we haven't really done that. We've weakened them, but it's one of those things that it is time for us to leave, and anybody would tell you that, the military as well as civilians.
Denise O'Brien, organic farmer, advocate from Atlantic, Iowa, and grandmother, we'll mention that at the end, speaking to us from her kitchen table outside of Atlantic, Iowa, on her farmstead. Denise, welcome back to the United States, and so good to talk to you and to learn that you came back with great experiences and in good health.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
Denise O'Brien, who for the past year has worked on a reconstruction team as a USDA advisor in Afghanistan. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.